Blog Talk Radio.
911, what are you reporting?
We got someone or something crawling around out here.
Did you see what it was? Was it a person or an animal or?
I can't tell. All I know is that my central light came on and I just happened to glimpse and see this thing running across the yard. A good sized man or something. It looks like a man. I don't know what it was, just that it ran across the yard.
Okay. You've had problems in the neighborhood before?
Yeah, my dog was killed here just recently. I don't want to go outside. Jesus Christ, you better.
Sir?
Dee up!
Hello?
Get somebody out here.
What's going on now, sir?
That son of a bitch is about 6'9", I don't know.
Do you see him now, sir?
Yes, I'm looking right at him.
Uh-oh. Okay, hang on.
He's right.
Is he in your yard, sir?
Yeah, God, he's big.
Okay, what's he doing in your yard?
He's looking at me.
Okay.
Anomalous Entertainment presents, in association with Blog Talk Radio, the Sasquatch Experience Radio Show, hosted by Sean Forker, Melissa Hovey, and James Baker. Join them as they take you on a quest to uncover one of the world's last great mysteries. The adventure begins right now.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Sasquatch Experience. I'm your host, Sean Forker, joined tonight by Melissa Hovey and James Baker, as always. Good evening, folks. How you doing?
Doing good, Sean. How are you?
Very good, very good. James, you with us, good friend?
Yeah.
All right. Well, folks, we got a great show for you tonight. For the next 2 hours, well, probably an hour, 45 minutes, James has a little bit he has to do here, and then the show goes over to Melissa Hovey, who's bringing you an excellent interview tonight with Bill Murray. Now, folks, the important thing to note is that we're going to need you to open a new browser and type in texassasquatch.blogspot.com, and that's going to give you some visual representations on what's being discussed on the show tonight. Bill Munns was kind enough to provide us some visuals, and hopefully you guys will turn over to that so you get a visual idea of what we're talking about. And Mel never disappoints with our interviews, and James and I will be here on hand to ask our questions as we go along. But predominantly, Mel is your host for the evening. I'm your moderator, call taker. And we ask that you save your calls for the last 10 minutes of each hour. So that's 10 minutes to the end of each hour at the number 1-347-996-5814. And James, since we're at a crunch for time here, my friend, take her away.
Okay, well, we have some kind of echo. Well, it's thing which is exciting and encouraging.
Folks, we do apologize. We're getting some kind of echo. Our soundboard is not cooperating as well as we had planned tonight. James, go ahead and try again.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yeah, that was better.
Okay. Thing was it? Okay. Spring. The signing is not exciting. On.
I'm still here, James. James, we are not having a. We're not hearing you, I guess, from the chat room. All they're getting is distortion.
Well, I think you might want to run with it.
All right. Well, Melissa, since we're having some technical issues with James, we'll try to bring him back in later once he gets reestablished. So why don't you go ahead and introduce our guest and take it away.
Thanks, Sean. Tonight we have a gentleman that I spoke with on Let's Talk Bigfoot. I have the same echo, Sean.
I'm not getting any. Well, I'm not getting any echo. I was getting it with James, so I do apologize, folks. Bear with us while I get this. Get some live help here to take care of it. And Melissa, do your best, hon, until I get us some help.
Okay, thanks. I interviewed Mr. Munns on Let's Talk Bigfoot a couple months ago. And we started out discussing Patty. For those of you who don't know, that would be the subject of the Patterson. And with me tonight is Mr. Bill Munns. Bill, are you there?
Yeah. You hear me okay?
I can hear you fine.
Okay, great. Yeah, I wasn't sure. This is kind of a different connection, and it seems like James is having a little trouble with his, but okay, I'm coming in loud and clear. We're good?
Yes, you're fine.
Oh, okay.
I've got Bill, you and Mel are coming in just great now, so
okay,
sorry to interrupt you there. Go ahead.
Okay.
All right. Well, just so you know, Sean, keep working on it. I still have my voice very well, twice. Okay. When we last spoke, Bill, we were in the part about Patty's hip.
Mm-hmm.
I believe we were discussing the what some people describe as their buckle.
Mm-hmm.
I think they call it a hernia.
Yeah, I've heard that term used.
Okay. What is your thought on that?
Well, before I go to that, let me just bring up what we had talked about and what you have on the blog site so that others know. What we plan to do is this first hour, we're talking about if Patty's a suit. Okay, that's our foundation premise. And we're talking about if it's a suit, what about this, what about that, what about such. And then the second hour, we're going to kind of look at it from a different perspective, if Patty and the phenomenon are real. Okay, so this segment, this hour, is the if Patty's a suit segment. Now, so that ties into what you were asking. Okay, let's go to the pelvis area and all of that stuff. Here is my principal concern if it is a suit, and we'll keep saying that frequently. There are three shadow lines there, one around the waist, one across the base of the buttocks going into the leg from the back on an upward diagonal toward the front, which sometimes changes and then halfway through goes straight up to the waist. And then there's a third kind of a shadow line across the thigh on the outside of the right leg on a kind of an upward diagonal. You have those three lines, and a lot of people who say, oh, yeah, it's a suit, I can tell it right away, just look at this line, that's a seam. You know, they look at those areas, and granted, they're very, very suspicious where those lines are. The problem with that whole analysis is that if we look at it from the standpoint of a professionally made suit, let's start with that, those three lines don't make any sense. Now, I've had some debates with some other people on the forums and such about how I myself would never build a suit that's split in two pieces with an upper part like a shirt and a bottom part like legs. But apparently Chris Whalis mentioned in some threads that he has done things like that, and a gentleman named Defoot has done a lot of research on earlier suits and apparently found quite a few examples of others in the past who have done that. So let's just assume for a moment that there is a suit and it splits an upper torso and a leg section. Okay, let's start there. It has one closure seam then that joins the upper part and the lower part. Now, to kind of digress a minute, you have two kinds of seams in a suit. One is tailoring seams, where you cut different pieces of the fur cloth together and stick them together just to shape them around the body. Those are glued. They never open and close. Then you have what's called a closure seam, which is the one that's got the Velcro, the zippers, or whatever, and that's what you have to open up to get somebody into the suit. Then you got to close it all up, brush it down, and then end of the day, you got to open it back up again, get the person out of it. That's a closure seam. Now, if we assume it's a suit and it's got an upper section and a lower section, then it's got a closure seam somewhere across the pelvic area. So you can easily look at one of those lines and say, see, that's the closure seam. It's so obvious. Here's this big shadow right across here. If you just take it to that level, makes sense. But if you then say, wait a minute, we've got three lines there. Are there three closure seams there? Well, I can guarantee you no professional would build a suit that way. Now, we, you know, some people like to bring up, what about a crazy drunken amateur? Okay, crazy drunken amateurs can do anything they like. So, in theory, a crazy drunken amateur could build three closure seams in those three spots. But for all practical purposes, let's just assume it's something well made by somebody who knows what they're doing, because there's other things in the suit that evidence that, if it's a suit. Okay? So you've got three lines there. If you say one of them is a closure seam, because look at it, it's just this line and it's a sharp demarcation, et cetera, et cetera. Well, then how do you explain the other two, which also are sharp lines? You know, as soon as you say, well, they may look like closure seams, but they're not, then you have to go back to the one you did call a seam and say, well, wait a minute, the only way you say it's a seam is because it looks like one, but then you're saying this other line looks like one, but it's not. So how do you reconcile that? That paradox is, frankly, the single most important element that isn't properly explained by anybody who wants to say that it's a suit, to be able to make sense of it. Until that is properly addressed, anybody who just looks at one line and says, yeah, that's a seam, I can spot it right away, see, here it is. If they don't address the other two and explain why those aren't seams, then their whole analysis sort of falls apart. So that's the pelvic thing that we were talking about before. Now, on the leg thing, which is one of those three lines, I know there's a lot of talk on the real side that it's some kind of a herniated bulge, which is basically swollen tissue, as much as I understand, that's kind of pushing out the skin. But let's set that aside for a moment, because we're in the if it's a suit segment. If it's a suit, and there's this line going across and this little flap coming up, if it's a suit, it would suggest that it's a loose piece of the fur cloth and that it's flapping upward. Okay, first, I'd find it hard to believe that anybody who built a suit would put a division of the fur cloth right across the thigh. You certainly can build a continuous piece of fabric going all the way down the leg, not any problem. So whether there'd even be anything to come loose there doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. Now, if you imagine that it's actually is made that way and it's got this loose flap of cloth, then you have another contradiction, in which if it suddenly flaps up, and I believe there's a couple of stills that have been pulled out where it seems to stick out suddenly, you're talking about a flap that suddenly pops up in an eighth of a second and then suddenly seems to go right back down again. Now, fur cloth can have loose flaps, and you can maybe brush it with your hand, and it can kind of pop up and settle down, but it's not going to happen in an eighth of a second. You can watch any real fabric in real time, and if something flaps or moves around, you'll see it in real time. It's not, you know, an eighth of a second. So trying to explain that in terms of motion and time, it's being a flap, doesn't quite make sense either. That's another kind of a contradiction there. Then we have one other contradiction with the whole suit, and that is, again, it's a contradiction of professionalism and amateurism. Now, you can say that the waist is very amateurish. There's seams here, lines here, stuff flapping up here. That sounds pretty amateurish. But what you've got going in the head, the neck, and the shoulder, if that's a suit, that's as good as it gets. Nothing was done that well until 1984, when Rick Baker did Tarzan the Legend of Greystoke, and he could only do it that well because he had the new stretch furs that National Fiber Technology introduced in the 80s. The older furs wouldn't do that. So if you're going to look at the head, neck, and such, you're looking at perfect professionalism, not just in building the suit, but in somebody actually there filming put the head on, blended it all, blended the closure seam between the head and the neck, and then brushed out the fur perfectly. Now, if that professional is there on the set and there's any flap of fur anywhere else on the suit, that same professional will glue down that flap and brush it all out before you ever let him turn a camera. So again, you got this amateur professional schizophrenia of what you see on the film that has never been well addressed by someone who's trying to advocate it's a suit. And these are some of the things that just completely confound me when I try to envision all of that being a suit. Does that answer the question?
One question I do have about towards the bottom, you know, the legs, the foot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To me, there doesn't seem to be like a division between what would be the foot piece and the leg.
Mm-hmm.
Is that pretty typical?
From a suit standpoint, not really. You can very easily just put a little seam, a vertical seam at the base of the foot and the fur cloth and the ankle that kind of opens up, and then you can simply slip on some type of an artificial foot and have it go up a little ways into the ankle, and then just take the fur cloth, pull it down, and then kind of close that seam. It's kind of like the standard cuff split on a shirt, a long sleeve shirt that has a button cuff, or where you put cufflinks, you know, it splits the same way. You can do that at the ankle so that you can get a real tight wrap of fur cloth around the ankle. And then because the hair is hanging downward where it stops, it just kind of hangs down on the foot. So from a suit mechanic standpoint, that's not a problem. That's an easy enough blend to do.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Could you explain to me what you think about the patty versus real, fake? I mean, from your own professional opinion.
Yeah. Okay. The way that I've been looking at it, what I have tried to focus on is my knowledge of how suits are built, what works, the way materials behave, everything else like that. I haven't gotten into any of the whole backstory of the people and the events. You know, there's this whole cottage industry of Roger Patterson's life before and such, trying to infer things, and I stay as far away from that as I can. I really do look at it purely from the standpoint of the physical or the functional mechanics. So I look at that body, and the first thing that I try to figure out is, okay, where are the seams? And the tailoring seams, which are just shaping the cloth, if they're on the body, they're superbly hidden. That's not terribly difficult to do. It certainly takes skill, but it's not impossible. But then you have these closure seams that I keep mentioning. Somehow or other, you got to get the person into it and out of it. Now, what's going on in the waist looks, to some extent, like there's some kind of a closure seam there.
Mm-hmm.
But what's going on in the head, the neck, into the shoulders, there has to be a closure seam there to remove the neck piece, or the head piece, excuse me. But there's absolutely no evidence of it. It's absolutely flawless, the way I've looked at it. Another thing, when I look at it personally, is that I know that the fur cloth of the time didn't stretch. It wasn't spandex-based. It was just, it was kind of like carpet, actually, or the standard fur cloth that's used for a standard fake fur coat. It bends, but it doesn't stretch. It doesn't have any real elasticity. So when it does bend, it bends the way cloth does. Those kind of cloth folds tend to be quite obvious as soon as you put a suit in motion with a person walking around. So from my perspective, I keep looking at this figure in the film, and I keep looking for evidence of the kind of folds that I expect fur cloth to do, and I don't see them. I know that there's a certain amount of degradation of the image quality, and that certainly is a point of contention about, you know, that maybe they're there, but because it's so grainy and all of that and such that you can't really see them. But you do see shapes and folds and light and dark patterns change. So you should be able to see some of these cloth folds occur as expected. And that I don't, which obviously piques my curiosity and inspires me to simply want to keep looking at this further and try to figure it out. So from my standpoint, the way I approach it entirely from these kinds of issues. I don't get into the biomechanics of a person or a non-person. I don't get into any of the backstory or anything else. I just really purely approach it from the standpoint of, if it's a suit, how is it built? How does this work? Why does this do this? Why doesn't this do this? Purely from the simple mechanics, and then I try to imagine it as a job and see it beginning to end. Okay, this is how I'd build it, and then, well, we got to take it out on the set, and we need a couple of assistants to help us out with this or that. You know, I look at it from that simple, practical standpoint, and I'll be very candid with you, even though now I've spent a couple of months kind of looking it through, I am still completely mystified by this. I see an occasional thing that seems almost amateurish to me, and then I see other things that just I cannot imagine anybody in the time having done, and the head, neck, shoulder blend is one of them. Now, I know it's been reported in some of the books, some of the documentaries, and other things that some people were analyzing the film back in the late 60s or 70s. They say that people at Disney were, or Universal. John Chambers, I know, has been interviewed where he's been quoted as saying, if it's a suit, it's better than anything I can do. I don't know the exact words on that. It was something to that effect that he had been quoted in an interview. My personal position is that I would agree with that comment of John Chambers. If it's a suit, it's better than anything that I think existed at the time. And particularly on the head, neck, shoulder thing, I don't think anything equaled it until 1984. So I have a tremendous amount of skepticism about the idea of a suit, even though I'm continuing to try to analyze it on the assumption that it is. But that's, I don't know, that's about the best way I can try to explain the situation, okay?
Okay. You have been part of Hollywood.
Yes.
For a very long time.
Mm-hmm, nearly 40 years.
Right. Have you ever heard rumors floating around that somebody within Hollywood was responsible?
I have read about them. I've never actually had somebody say that to my face, no. I know there was certainly a lot of talk and discussion when I was starting out in the late 60s, early 70s, because we were just curious, and I'd occasionally talk to somebody about it, but offhand, I don't recall anybody ever telling me firsthand, oh yeah, it's a suit, and this is how it was done, and this person did it. I have read a lot of reports. John Landis is often quoted as saying John Chambers did it. And other suit makers have sometimes been quoted as saying, you know, different things like, yeah, it's a suit. Or, of course, I have heard rumors that Tom Berman did it. Tom was actually John Chambers' apprentice when he got started on Planet of the Apes, and then, of course, has gone on to a very, very distinguished career as a very, very fine prosthetic and effects makeup artist, and I believe he's still practicing now. I've heard rumors, you know, that Tom is the one. I've heard rumors that John Chambers did it. There seem to be some rumors about a very talented suit mime and stuntman named Janos Prochazka, where he built some suits, or maybe it was some of his, or that he was in it and such. There are a lot of rumors swirling around, but frankly, I see as much contradiction in the rumors to the point that I don't particularly see any one as having merit, and if you can't finalize one story and actually get the one story crystal clear, these stories just kind of null each other out, you know, in my mind.
Yeah.
And that plus the fact that Hollywood is full of stories that don't have an ounce of truth to them. You know, I think Hollywood was built on that.
Okay, for those of you that are listening, please pull up my blog, because we're going to go to one part of that right now. You can find that at txsasquatch.blogspot.com. Okay, Bill, you were great to really send me this information. Let's first start with the reconstructing the creatures. That's a great montage. The photos are fantastic. Could you explain a little bit about this to people and the importance, why you felt they needed to read this? Do you have that in front of you? I think we lost our guest. Okay, everybody, just hold on. We're having some serious issues tonight with Blog Talk.
Well, we have Bill joining us back in again, Mel, and we have James Baker joining us too. Bill, sorry about that. We seem to have lost you. And James,
okay.
Welcome back.
You
back with
got,
me, Bill?
Yeah, have you got me again? This is Bill.
Yes, we got you again, Bill.
Okay, fine. Just making sure.
Wonder of the Internet.
Oh, yes.
All right. For those of you who are reading my blog, scroll down to the portion called Reconstructing Creatures, Suits, Creatures, and Other Strains by Bill Munn. Okay. Bill, would you discuss this a little bit?
Sure. Why don't we start with that first chart, which I believe was making suits and stuff like that?
Right.
Okay. What I put together there was a sample of things that I had done back in the 70s when I was the director of a school training makeup artist. The reason I put that particular chart together is that one of the biggest issues when we talk about If Patty's a Suit is the question of what materials and processes and techniques were available in 67 and before. Because a lot of people who seem to have some knowledge of makeup suits, et cetera, today do tend to forget that there was a tremendous revolution of technology in the makeup effects field about 1980. It's like 28 years ago. And some people don't realize that things were a lot different before then. Now, a lot of people talk about it and they do research. They find old pictures and maybe talk to an occasional person who worked then with information. But there's a whole different perspective if you've actually done the things the old way, the old method, the old work. Now, in that sense, I feel that I have an unusual perspective on the issue of how things done in the old days, because when I was at this school, I literally spent 6 years looking at old classic makeup processes or effects and literally rebuilt them in their entirety. You know, didn't just look at the picture, didn't just ask somebody how did you do it, actually rebuilt them in their entirety. And what that gave me was a very, very powerful understanding of the technology of the time, like some of the old monster movies from the 50s, some of the earlier stuff in the 60s going into the 70s. It gave me an understanding of the technology then as compared to what technology eventually developed in the 80s and 90s and so on. Now, at the time, I had no idea that it would be relevant to this particular issue of Patty, because that is a crucial issue that just keeps coming up, and I'm sure you've seen it and read about it 100 times, where people say, but don't talk about suits now. How were suits built in 67 or before? And that really becomes an issue. What methods and processes were used before then? And this particular chart is just illustrating the fact that I spent 6 years studying a lot of these old-time processes and literally rebuilding them in their entirety so that I could better understand how things were done. Now, it wasn't at the time intended to be applied for this purpose. It was just because I felt that my students truly deserve to understand how things were done so they can have a clearer understanding of the new things and why they might be better, plus the fact that a really good makeup artist needs to know sometimes the old-fashioned techniques, because sometimes in a pinch on a crazy movie set where everything's going wrong, you throw out all the new rule books and you have to rely on plain, simple, old-fashioned technology. And so knowing how it was done before, as well as knowing some of the newer things, gives a person a much rounder education, makes them a more capable professional. So that was the intention of that, and that's what that first chart sort of illustrates. But oddly enough, I don't know, maybe this is a destiny kind of a thing, I don't know, that particular study of older makeup and suit technology gave me what I feel is a very, very clear perspective on the whole if Patty's a suit issue, because it really did kind of crystallize in my mind what kinds of processes were being done then, as opposed to the newer processes that were introduced like in the 90s, and of course what's being done now. So that's the point of that first chart, is to kind of simply illustrate what I actually did during that particular time period as far as recreating classical makeups and suits and such and studying some of their classical technology. Okay?
Okay, now if Patty is a suit,
right,
which is on topic of what we're talking,
mm-hmm,
do you think that whoever did it could have gotten away with the costume only and no makeup?
I'm sorry, the end of your question broke up for me.
Okay. Do you think they could have gotten away with just the costume and no makeup, like, you know, around the eyes or anything like that?
Well, if you use a full costume like that and you have a face mask, blending into the eyes isn't terribly difficult if you're not putting the face in close-up that's well-lit, and that isn't the case in the film. So if you really knew it was going to be staged that way and photographed from a distance, the blend on the eyes wouldn't be anything terribly critical, especially considering it's falling into shadow. So, yeah, it would basically be just a suit. You just put on all the pieces and you close it all up and maybe smudge a little dark makeup or some black cream liner around the eyes, and then just, you know, you kind of go with it. So that wouldn't have been any particular problem from that standpoint. The main thing that I look at from a standpoint of a suit is the fact that after you get somebody into a fursuit, somebody's got to groom it. You know, the whole process of getting somebody into it messes up the hair, and it all goes in crazy directions, and then the seams are not laying down quite flat. So somebody's got to come in and brush it all out, and that isn't the person inside the suit. Now, everything I've heard when people describe how it all really went down, they seem to think it was Patterson Gimlin and somebody there in a suit. That's it. Now, to me, that does not make a whole lot of sense, because it seems like somebody who knows what they're doing had to be there that day to help get them into the suit and then groom it all, get it ready for camera. That's a kind of a question in my mind that I've never heard any logical explanation for. But around the eyes, the mask, no, I wouldn't concern that.
You know, according to this, you've worked on, and I find this amazing, The Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Well, I didn't do the original. That was when I was like 5 years old, but I've made an identical complete suit of it, yeah. Literally built the entire thing.
And how long did it take you?
It was a couple of months.
Something like that.
A couple of months. In terms of actual working hours, it's probably about 250, 300 working hours, I would say. The full body sculpture alone was probably about 80 hours of that.
Wow.
So about 300 working hours, yeah. It's
okay,
it's quite a lot of time. You got to have a lot of patience to, you know, go through one of those beginning to end.
Right. Okay, now, would you mind going through the second?
The second chart, the strange one, yes. Okay, that was in part just to kind of illustrate how strange the whole suit business itself can be, because we are often called upon to make some awfully strange things. There's one picture on the upper left, which is a very cartoonish character. That was done for Ruby Spears, an animation company. And they had a cartoon character, and they wanted a live person to walk around like their cartoonish character. So that was intended to be cartoonish from the beginning. But it's a good illustration of the kind of fur that was available. That was done in the 70s, actually. But that would have been the kind of fur you would expect to see in the 60s as well. And as you can see, it's just, you know, kind of a straight up and down basic body. There's no definition of the body or the muscles or anything on it. You just don't have that in a lot of the suits like that. So that really does kind of illustrate about as much as you'd normally expect from that kind of fur material and that kind of process. The bear head that is the next one over, going to the right of that, is one that was done for a television commercial in 87, I believe. That was actually the head of a full bear suit that I made, and it's actually an animatronic head that has like 7 facial movements in it that are all radio controlled. But the main thing about that is that the fur there is the stretch spandex fur that is custom woven by National Fiber Technology in Massachusetts. And when you order that, you actually specify everything: your colors, your density, the color of the base fur, how thick you want it, everything about it. You specify, and they custom weave it. And it's on this wonderful stretch spandex backing, and it produces a really remarkable effect. And I think you can see, just in comparing the two, you know, there's a slightly higher level of realism on the bear than on the other fuzzy thing next to it. That's the kind of realism that suit technology is capable of now, and the kind that was capable of in the 80s. But that kind of fur did not exist back in the 60s. So that's kind of a comparison of the best fur now as compared to the kind of fur that was more common or available in 67. There's a couple of pictures there that show things related to sculpting a suit. I think it's me sculpting the Swamp Thing body, because that's another way of building a suit, is to literally sculpt the entire thing and then cast it in parts. And then there are two pictures of me actually in a suit. The relevance of that is that if you build a suit, you really need to understand not just how to make it, but you need to understand the whole reality of how to work it, how to get a person into it and out of it, the physical stress the person might endure wearing the suit and such. And so it's actually a lot of people who build suits do actually perform in them. So I'm not unusual in that respect. I know Rick Baker has done almost all of the gorilla work that he's ever done. He performed in it. Quite a number of other people have. It gives you a better understanding of all of the realities, because it isn't just a matter of building the suit. Putting it on, dressing it, grooming it, and the stress of performing in it are factors that have to be taken into consideration when you're trying to analyze. If you're looking at the PG film and saying, oh yeah, it's a suit, well, you have to think through the dressing, the grooming, and the stress imposed on the person wearing it. You must factor those into an analysis. So a person who's actually done, climbed into the suits and thrashed around in them and all kinds of crazy stuff in front of a camera, it gives you a little clearer perspective on those particular considerations in your analysis. You know, there are some sort of armchair analysts who don't have a clue what it's like to get into a suit or wear it or perform in it or sweat in it or anything else like that, you know, who just kind of think, well, you just have to build it and that's all that matters. But the realities of dressing it, grooming it, wearing it do really factor into the analysis quite heavily. And so that particular thing was just sort of illustrating that I do have some familiarity with those realities, having actually climbed into them and worn them. There is in the middle on the left side, I believe, a couple of pictures of a chimpanzee in the rough form of a gorilla suit. Now, that might sound a little strange, why put a chimp in a gorilla suit. Problem with people in gorilla suits is the fact that biologically they can't, their whole body system is not set up the same way. Their arms are not the right length and everything else. A chimp is much closer to a gorilla in terms of that anatomy. And so back in the 80s, when I was working with some animal trainers and we were bidding on some movies to do gorilla work, we came up with this idea of why not make chimps up like that instead. Now, building the suit's actually the same process. You have your understructure and your padding, and then you put your fur on and all. That all is pretty much the same. But, you know, the obvious difficulties of, you know, trying to get the chimp to wear it, that takes a little bit more challenge, and wear the facial prosthetics and the wigs and such like that. But that just illustrates the fact that even something that strange actually is possible. There's a lot of rather extraordinary things that actually can be done with suits and such. And my particular background, I probably had more experience working with animals than most people. I think that brings us down to the bottom pictures on that panel, which are the really weird ones. There is one of me putting a scar on an actual African lion. There's one of me painting an elephant gold, and I'm sure you're wondering why in the world are we painting an elephant gold. And then there's one of me with an orangutan where I'm actually putting a prosthetic nose on him and making him look half human. Now, just to explain, the lion was for a movie where he was supposed to be having a scar on his face. So just basically put a scar on him. The other gentleman in the picture is John Gillespie, the trainer, who is watching the lion very carefully to see that he doesn't get pissed off while I put the scar on his face. The gold elephant was actually for a television commercial for a Danish chocolate, and their logo was a little gold elephant with short little cute tusks and everything, and they wanted a live elephant for filming a representation of their commercial. So I had to make tusks for the elephant that were about a foot and a half long, and they clipped onto the little pegs that were left of her own tusks. And then I and the two animal trainers who worked her, we literally sprayed her solid gold with about 15 cases of Streaks and Tips temporary hairspray. And, you know, we literally used 10 cases of that stuff each day spraying her down. So that's why I am spraying the elephant gold. On the orangutan that's sort of made into a human thing, the owner of the orang wanted to use that particular orang, suggesting a semi-human character. Now, normally you take an actor and try to make him less human. It doesn't really work that well. This particular man, Ralph Helfer, the owner of the orang, he came up with this idea, why don't we take an orang and make him more human to get him halfway? So this was basically just a test makeup to see, A, what it would look like, and B, would the orang allow us to do it? Now, the orang was actually a fairly decent working orang, so he tolerated it quite well. And as you and I had talked about before the program, that orang is one of the two that was in the Clint Eastwood movies, not the first Any Which Way You Can, but I think it was the second Any Which whatever the second one was.
Any Which Way But Loose.
Yeah, Which Way But Loose, which had the older orang, Clyde, and then the young girlfriend, Clyde, which was actually a boy, and this is the one that played the young girlfriend orang, having grown up. This is a few years after that film, so he's a little bigger and heavier. But he was actually quite surprisingly receptive to allowing me to put on the nose prosthetic and add some hair and put on his facial makeup and such. So those particular things, you know, are illustrating some of the strangeness of the business. The reason, though, that I also included them is that when you talk about Patty in particular or any kind of analysis of the suit or such like that, there comes an issue that people debate endlessly of what looks real and what doesn't. And from my perspective, judgments of what's real and what doesn't comes from actually studying real animals, real nature. And the reason I put those illustrations up was to show that because of my rather unusual background, looking at these animals, I mean literally eyeball to eyeball, 2 feet away, watching them for an hour, watching all their movements, their gestures, their behavior, the way the skin bends and folds, the way the hair flops around, really actually paying that close attention, sort of gives me a strong perspective on what's real and what isn't, what seems natural, what doesn't. And so those experiences working that closely with a lot of different kinds of animals over the years certainly kind of tempers my judgment when it comes to issues of look at Patty, is Patty real or not, You know, some people say, no, that just doesn't look real to me. Well, my perspective on it is the more you study nature, the more hesitant you are to say, that's not real, because the realities in nature are nothing short of astonishing. And having looked at these animals up close and personal, as I have doing these various jobs, that's really expanded my perception that the realities of life are immensely diverse. And so I don't rush to look at Patty in the film and say, no, that doesn't look real. I've seen too much reality that's stranger than anything in the PG film to easily dismiss it that way, as I know some other people do. Final thing on the bottom, I just thought I would mention, you and I actually talked about this a little earlier. I just put a side note in there of the fact that after those pictures were taken of different animals, one of those animals killed a zookeeper about 3 weeks later. Now, we look at trained animals, movie animals, and you think, oh, aren't they just cute? They're trained, they're harmless, they're this and that. The reality is they're not harmless. They're still potentially dangerous. And even when you're doing something like that, if you ever do, that's why I put that don't do this at home. You know, if you ever do get an opportunity to actually be close to animals, no matter how much anybody assures, oh, they're trained movie animals, there's no problem, there's a potential for danger there. There's actually something in the news today about a lady in an animal compound in Florida who was handling two cheetahs, and they attacked her and put her in the hospital. You know, the real animals, however well-trained they are, they're still wild animals, and they have a potential for, you know, attacking people, and they have a potential for killing people. And
Even a domesticated animal like a dog, you can never bite anybody and then one day just bite someone.
Oh, yeah. And especially if they're like a Rottweiler, pit bull, or something like that, they can kill people. That's not a problem if they turn on them, yeah. Or even some of the dogs that are trained as guard or attack dogs.
Yeah.
Now, we put a little note on the bottom. I just thought that might be kind of an interesting thing for the program of which one of the animals is the killer. And I thought, I don't know if people can message in or something like that. If anybody wants to vote on that, we will reveal that to the audience at the end of our program, right before 7 o'clock or 9 o'clock your time when we sign off. But if anybody does want to, you know, get in on the vote, is it the lion, the elephant, or the orangutan? One of those actually did kill a man 3 weeks after that picture was taken.
Okay. Everybody, take a look at those pictures, and you decide, and then vote. Who do you think did this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was a pretty interesting question. We do have a question from the chat room, and it comes from Henry May.
Okay.
And his question is, what is your reaction to Rick Baker's assertion that the creature's fur is not real?
First of all, I have the highest respect for Rick. He is without a doubt one of the true geniuses of the profession. And I did know him personally back in the 70s, and he's a man of impeccable integrity. So I'll start off with that, and I have the highest regard for Rick's opinion. As far as an opinion about something looking fake or not, I suppose every one of us in the profession will form an opinion like that, and everyone certainly is entitled to their opinion. If Rick does in fact feel that way about it, I respect his opinion. I will not rush to the same conclusion. The more I look at the film, the more I suspect the way the image quality is and the grain structure on the film, plus the duplication and everything, I suspect that that has altered the capacity of us to really actually tell how real or unreal the fur is. And it's possible that in this process and with some of the image enhancements, it's entirely possible that those enhancements might have bumped up one particular visual trait that might then make fur seem more artificial or seem more real than it may have been in actuality. And because I haven't finalized anything in my mind of how much this photographic process and the grain and everything, how much that may have actually changed the appearance of the fur, I'm hesitant to make that kind of a judgment myself. If Rick wants to make that judgment, of course, you know, like I say, I have the utmost respect for his opinion and certainly would always defend his right to want to express it. But the more I look at the film and the more I realize that there are some things that are missing based upon the grain structure of the film, I wonder if one of the things that's missing is the one thing that really would conclusively tell us, is it fake fur or is it real fur of a living creature? So I guess that would be my best response to that question.
All right, folks, it's at the top of the hour. We're going to take a commercial break here. But before we go to break, I'd like to pass on some sad news that just came my way. Ranger Tim Cassidy, a guest on our show numerous times, just learned that his mother has passed away. So our thoughts and prayers go out with Tim Cassidy and his family as they go through this tough and trying time. And we come back from the commercial break. James Baker will be joining us with the Bake Shock segment. Thank you, folks. See you at the top of the hour.
Introducing Anomalous Entertainment. Bringing you the best in paranormal talk radio on the web today. Our journey takes us to Sunday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern with The Sasquatch Experience, hosted by Sean Forker, Henry May, and James Baker. Uncovering the truths behind one of America's last great mysteries. We move on to Tuesday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern with The Bigfoot Quest, hosted by Bob Coyne, Mike Killen, and Chris Julian. Thursday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern, The Sasquatch Triangle, hosted by veteran Bigfoot researcher Don Keating of the Eastern Ohio Bigfoot Center. Bigfoot research from a Midwestern perspective. And on Friday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern, Sean Forker and Eric Altman take you beyond the edge. The world of the paranormal never became interesting. Anomalous Entertainment. Uncovering the world's mysteries, one anomaly at a time.
And folks, we're back. James, you with us, my good friend?
Yeah. Now that we're not having technical difficulties, I'll try again.
All right, buddy, go ahead.
It's spring, so the Sasquatch search is going to pick up. Plus, we have a lot of more people out in the woods, you know, camping, walking, hiking. Just wanted to, you know, point out a few things, you know, to remember this year for safety, and so your trip is a positive memory, not do you know what happened to blah, you know. Hunting and fishing seasons, at least in Pennsylvania, and I know as we go farther down south and even west, are still active. So, you know, wear the right clothes, wear enough orange, you know, if you need to. You know, a brisk nature walk can turn into a fatal accident faster than a speeding bullet. You know, also, you know, as you're hiking, remember that a short hike can turn into a long one if you get turned around, so wear comfortable boots and shoes so that way then your feet are dry and clean. Plus the fact is, you know, hey, you're out there for a few hours. After a while, it seems like a death march if you've got the wrong shoes on. Wear some long pants and clothes. As you know, we have the weeds, the briars, deer ticks. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but Lyme disease is kind of nasty. Always bring plenty of water and food in case you get turned around. You know, bring a cell phone or a radio with you. If you can, and you are Sasquatch searching or even hiking, bring a group of people with you, because that way then, you know, there's somebody there if there is an accident. I always carry a walking stick if I can, because it's good support, and it also helps me test the ground to make sure that it's safe for me to walk on. Also, if you, you know, are in a situation where you see animals or something that you don't want to get near you, you can always put the stick, you know, against the rock or something to make some noise to drive it away. When you do go out searching for Sasquatch, we do ask, you know, have an open mind. Make sure you come in with the right attitude about it. I mean, even if you don't believe, going out there, search, look at the evidence and look at it with an open mind, but don't dream every twig has got to be a footprint. Always pack out your trash, leave the area better than you found it. In your local newspapers, I've noticed they have an outdoor section. This week's outdoor section from the Sun Gazette, which you can get from the sungazette.com, a lot of my blog articles actually come from them. They have a lot of different classes you can take in your area. Now, in our area right now, they're doing fishing and trapping and general hunting skills, which may help you with the search for, you know, Bigfoot and teach you some basic skills. The nice thing with it is most of the classes are free. All you have to do is free up an afternoon and tell them. You know, let me see, what else do I got today? Eric Altman, BS chairman, has been nice enough to send me the 2008 annual East Coast Bigfoot poster for the conference on September 27th. That's on my blog at myspace.com/JamesBWild. Please,
wait,
if you have a
poster.
Huh? Yeah, I got it.
It's a poster.
Huh?
It's a sweet-looking poster.
Yeah, I got that emailed this afternoon, and I blogged it. It gives us times, phone numbers you need to get a hold of, how much everything costs. You know, so it's 6 months away, you know, plan your trip ahead.
Sasquatch Experience team, we'll be there.
Yep, it's going to be a nice time for everybody, you know. And I noticed on it there's a meet and greet the night before, and probably there'll be some other events as time goes on. Also, if you have the time, you know, the PBS phone number is on there, that if you'd like to be a member, because as I've become a member, I've actually found out of a lot of things that are going on in our area, as in Pennsylvania. And I'm sure, you know, in Melissa's area, you know, in other areas of the country, there are other groups, you know. And those groups probably have events going on, but I know that April, May, and June, that there are a lot of little things that are going on in different parts of PA, and you can find out where they are and who to get contact with. That's pretty much what I have for news. I just say the big thing, like I said, is I wanted to go over those little things about spring, because I know that the biggest thing that I always worry about is being out there is, you know, anybody would ever get hurt. Because, you know, we don't need that. Does anybody have anything to add?
Well, James, you know, you were talking about walking sticks.
Yeah.
And when you and I were out on a hike in Pennsylvania, out in Southwestern, you and I came across this area that seemed to be filled with a lot of sinkholes. And it was a good thing we had a walking stick with us, because one of us could have seriously gotten hurt walking into one of those and not really knowing how stable it was.
Actually, it was the morning, and like the top of it was iced over, so it really didn't, when you first stepped in, it didn't crank down, like, right in.
Which is kind of amazing, because I'm not exactly a lightweight.
No, not at all.
They're always good, thanks, James. They're always good to have a walking stick for multiple purposes. Your squatching kit's pretty good, James. The only thing I would recommend is, you know, to make sure they bring along some evidence collection tools, you know, some latex gloves. I always prefer powder free. And some paper baggies, not plastic. And, you know, some tweezers and a measuring tape. Preferably a ribbon tape, not a, you know, craftsman slide-out job.
That's one thing is also on my blog underneath that is some ideas for a Sasquatch kit. And please, you know, send me your answers because I know that I've gotten quite a few comments on some things to add. Now, a lot of people are going with, like, the GPS and some of the higher-end things, and I'm working off my budget, so my stuff is a lot lighter than that. But, you know, a good compass sometimes can be the GPS. You know, if you know the area well, you know, or go with somebody who knows the area, you know.
It's the good thing about having James Baker around, you know, and this isn't a knock on James, but James has put together a, you know, budget-friendly Bigfoot kick when, you know, gas is starting to be, you know, over $3 and 30 cents a gallon. It pays to be mindful on some things. So, James, thanks for those, you know, good, you know, Squatch kit tips, but also economical tips there. Anything else for you tonight, James?
No, I'm good. I'm sorry we had technical difficulties earlier, but I really... one thing I did want to mention while I've got the moment, do you still have that article on the mountain lion?
Yes, I do. From Hughesville, Pennsylvania, a woman was going down the highway, and she happened to have come upon a mountain lion carcass. Interesting enough, mountain lions don't exist in Pennsylvania, according to the Game Commission. But you know, once again, and this the lady that actually cited it worked for the Department of Transportation. But what's you know, the catch 22 of it all is the Game Commission goes back to its same old story that the Game Commission officials have steadfastly said that any cougars that may be sighted in this state are either abandoned or escaped pets brought into the state illegally and are likely Western cougars. And James, you and I both know that's a load of crap.
Well, the reason I brought the article up is the simple fact is people say to me all the time, I don't believe in Sasquatch because they say it's not out there. Well, they didn't believe that mountain lion was out there, but I believe that woman. They said the one woodpecker out west was extinct, and damn, he showed up. You know, so if we could miss those things, and, you know, I'm saying a mountain, you know, mountain lion smaller, but you know what I mean. It's still the same concept. You know, there is it puts doubt on the people that say, hey, we know what we're doing. We know that there's absolutely nothing there because we're right and you're wrong. And the thing is it comes down to the fact is they're not willing to budge a little bit and look at the evidence. And I think that the stories like the mountain lion and the woodpecker and different things that they find, I think those stories help us because the fact is it shows that you could be a complete expert and, you know, and yet you can still be wrong. I mean, I sell electronics for a living, and A and B are supposed to connect up and give you a certain thing, and 10% of the time A and B can connect up perfectly, and you get a whole different thing, you know.
Right on, James, right on. So
listen,
some nice articles. Good article you passed my way, James. Thank you for that.
Melissa, did you have anything to add before we break off on back to what you were doing?
Well, I guess the only thing that I would like to say to people is any dollar store out there, and please keep this in mind, any dollar store out there carries tweezers, pre-packed and sealed. So, and they're a dollar. So,
good dollar store.
That, oh, yeah, any dollar store. Yeah.
I go to the Dollar General and the Dollar Tree.
Yep, buy a fistful of those and put a couple in your backpack, and you already have pre-cleaned, sterilized tweezers. So that's what I do.
Well, there you go, folks. Big footing on a budget. And Melissa, you read me?
Oh, yeah, I hear you.
All right, big footing with a budget, folks. James Baker, our budget-friendly, budget-conscious Sasquatcher roaming the woods of eastern Pennsylvania. If you hear a noise outside, don't shoot. Make sure it's not James.
I am a large creature in the woods.
He is. And Melissa, back to you.
Well, Sean, you know what we haven't done tonight? We haven't done our shout-out to the listeners and the people in the chat room.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. We have a shout-out of people listening in the chat room. We got people listening in the home here. Everybody excited about the show and other things. So here we go. Down the list, we've got Don Daly, Millie, Demon 75, Red Rat Snake, Melissa Javi, I don't know who she is, Bigfoot Quest, Mark Footery, Thunderhawk, Reverend Shrone, Duke, 0002, Tom S., Long Island Yeti, Janice Carter, Squitch, Old Crow, Derek, Tech Squatch, Really Beats Me, Petey Westro, hello Petey, how you doing? Kite Squatch, Freak Freak, our den mother Karen O, John Cartwright, Huge Bowel Movements, Crypto Corner, Bill Green, Donnie, Bipedalist, and me, the Sasquatch Experience. What a rowdy group we got.
Okay. Let's get back to this, to our interview with Mr. Munns. Bill, are you there?
Yep, still here. That is a rowdy group you guys got.
Yeah. He has a party going on tonight, I guess it's WrestleMania night or something.
Okay. Wow.
And good news, I no longer have that annoying echo of my own voice coming back at me, so hopefully the second hour will go along much easier than the last.
Okay, good.
Okay. So now the second hour is a discussion, as you mentioned in the first part. The second hour we are going to discuss if Patty is real.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're not talking about, so for those of you that are sitting there in the skeptical mind, you know, don't lose your minds right now on us.
Mm-hmm.
We are simply discussing the idea of if Patty is real, if Bigfoot is real. We're using Patty as our, as the animal to point back to. Because
example A?
Right. That's the only footage that we have that is so clear, and you can actually, you know, use that as an example. So we're using Patty as the example for if Bigfoot is real. Okay. Bill, you were involved in a really interesting project with the San Diego Museum.
Mm-hmm.
Would you mind telling people a little bit about that?
Absolutely. As I'm sure you and probably most of the readers know, I sort of am known for that particular picture of Gigantopithecus with me standing beside him. That was part of what I had started to do in the late 80s, where I wanted to do things that were more scientific and more artistically fulfilling than swamp things and silly zombies and all of that craziness. So I started focusing more on scientific reconstructions of existent primates, prehistoric primates, and also because I'm fascinated by the whole human origin study, I wanted to do things related to some of the ancestral fossils that have been found over the years. So I started doing some of these reconstructions of various fossil ancestors over the years, from the late 80s going on into early 1991. And I had developed a very fine relationship with the San Diego Museum of Man, and specifically a lady named Rose Tyson, who's their curator of physical anthropology. She had been a wonderful friend and colleague. From that, I started thinking about the whole process of reconstructing human ancestors, and I'd done a certain amount of it, and I sort of realized that this might have the makings for a very fascinating exhibit, both in how the process is done, but also in some of the public perceptions of the concept of these reconstructed ancestors. So I talked it over with Rose, and she liked the idea, and we took it to the president or the director of the museum, and I put a formal proposal together, and we basically developed the idea of a joint venture museum exhibit where I would create all of the new reconstructions that would go into the exhibit, and then they would contribute all of the archival material. Example, they have, you know, like old posters and things that go back to 1910, 1920, photographs from early reconstructions that were done in museums, maybe in the 30s. And all of these archaic things portrayed our human ancestors as violent apes. That was a very, very popular idea in the 40s, was this, you know, the man, the hunter kind of primitive ape, killer ape kind of stuff. Or there were a lot of depictions of, like, Neanderthal as a very stupid prehuman. And so when they would do reconstructions, like in the Field Museum in Chicago, I believe, they have this group of Neanderthals, and they all look like they're autistic, like they've got Down syndrome or something. For some reason, they caught onto this idea that they were dumb. So the museum was going to contribute all of this archival material on the old-fashioned perceptions of what we thought our ancestors were like and what they looked like. And then I would contribute all the new reconstructions based upon the casts of all the various fossil skulls, and we included a full skeleton of Lucy, and then a complete reconstruction of what she might have looked like, alive and well, walking, you know, in the lands of Ethiopia or whatever. So we put together this joint exhibit, and the San Diego Museum hosted it for 5 or 6 months, I believe around 91, maybe 92. And then they rented out the exhibit, and it traveled around the country for 5 years. I think about 20 other museums picked it up as a short-term traveling exhibit, and then it went over to Europe for a couple of years. And finally, the San Diego Museum bought out all of the new contemporary stuff, and they've included it into a new exhibit that they developed. So some of what I created is all still there as well. So that's how the joint venture kind of came about, and it was apparently a very, very successful program. Now, one of the two charts that you put up on your website, it's the last one, I believe, in the bottom, actually, shows this reconstruction process. There's two ways to do it. One is what's called tissue depth studies. That's where you use these little round discs of clay that have different thicknesses, and you put them on different parts of the skull, and that suggests how far out from the bone the surface of the skin is. Now, tissue depth studies work very well in forensic reconstructions of modern humans. If the police find a skull and they're trying to figure out, okay, let's investigate what happened to this person, what did they look like? Maybe we can develop something like that to help us find the identity of this remains. Tissue depth studies work very well there. They don't work as well with hominid fossils, prehistoric ones, because the tissue depth studies are of contemporary humans, not of the prehistoric forms, and it's entirely possible that the fleshy mass on the skulls could be different in terms of its volume. So the method that I have diagrammed on that chart, it shows basically how the second alternative for reconstructing an ancestor or reconstructing any fossil species, and that's to actually build it up muscle by muscle, tissue mass by tissue mass, based on your expectations of its anatomy. With muscles, you generally know where it starts and where it ends, its insertion and its origin. And you get an idea based on the bone structure, like, well, there's a big muscle that operates the jaw that goes underneath the cheekbone. And you can pretty well tell by how far the cheekbone sticks out how big that muscle is going in there. So you get a sense of it. And then there's a little ridge across the top of the side of the cranium where that muscle finally hooks in and kind of grabs, and you can kind of see where that is, so you kind of know how far the muscle goes up. So building the face muscle by muscle by muscle is a fairly reliable way of actually kind of fleshing out a particular face, and that one chart actually shows the process so you can see how it happens. Now, there's another curious thing in the chart that was part of the exhibit, actually. When you reconstruct anything, and this is whether it's a human ancestor or a Gigantopithecus or anything, when you reconstruct it, when it comes to skin pigment and hair patterns, it's total guesswork. If someone tries to tell you they can determine that scientifically, well, the truth is they can't. Pigmentation and hair patterns are purely speculative, so all we can really do is take what we might call an educated guess. Now, what I thought would be interesting, and Rose happened to agree, and we put it into the exhibit, was to take one particular face, and it's the one that's pictured there, the Peking man, the Homo erectus figure, and in the middle on the far right side was my first reconstruction. In other words, that was kind of what I thought he might look like. But I realized there were a lot of other possibilities. So that whole row along the bottom is the exact same face, but I tried to do a whole variety of different possible skin pigmentations, hair colors, hair patterns, hair textures, all of which are theoretically plausible. Any one of those could have been what it actually looked like. And I think this is actually the first time this was ever done in an exhibit, rather than just do one and say, this is it, this is what he looked like. We actually said, we don't know. We can guess this, we can guess that, but this is really speculative. And so we were, you know, kind of up front and saying, this is, you know, several possible ways of what it could look like. And I think in the exhibit we actually set up a little voting booth where people could actually vote on one and say, I think he looks like this one, or I think he looks like that one. And then you could see kind of a running tally. It was kind of an interactive exhibit. So that that kind of explains that particular chart, and all of the illustrations from that chart do stem back from this particular Faces on Fossils exhibit with the museum.
Hmm. Okay, let's go back up to the first set of photographs.
Mm-hmm.
Where you show Patty, Giganto, Blackie, and Zinge?
Zinge.
Most researchers in this know about Gigantopithecus.
Right.
And they've also heard the correlation to a couple of others, Australopithecus.
Yes.
I've heard somebody, I think, say, I'm going to try to pronounce it because I know I'm going to butcher it.
Some of them are tongue twisters, yes.
Right.
Uh-huh.
So, okay, and you and I have had this conversation before about Gigantopithecus.
Right.
But now you are of the opinion that Gigantopithecus wouldn't have the same structure as what we're seeing in Patty. Is that what you're saying?
Not quite. Let me clarify that. Back when I was doing the Giganto figure, which was 87, 20 years ago, all prevailing opinion within the people who, you know, were certainly willing to think, you know, that the phenomenon is real, all prevailing opinion seemed to assume that the logical ancestor was Giganto, because they seemed to feel that physical size was the defining criteria. Giganto is estimated to have been about 9 feet tall. Reports of Sasquatch are 6, 7, 8 foot tall. Seemed like a good match. Okay, so you're talking about a giant ape now. Here's a giant ape from the past. Connection. That was, as much as I understand, the sort of mainstream thing. And I know Grover Krantz, very, very knowledgeable anthropologist. I had the chance to meet him back then. He was a very definite advocate of the Giganto-Bigfoot parallel. And so at the time, I really didn't delve into that terribly much myself. I sort of just accepted that that was the prevailing opinion. It actually wasn't until the last couple of months when I really started looking at the Patterson film frame by frame over and over and over again, and I guess now just in the last few months I've probably watched it, you know, 50 or 100 times, that I really started to rethink the whole idea. Purely from my perspective, if Gigano were the ancestor, I know there's debate on whether or not he's bipedal or he's quadrupedal. Russell Shahan, that I worked with, he feels that Giganto is a knuckle-walking quadruped. Grover, I believe, felt that he might be a biped. Now, the discrepancy there is first that we have absolutely no bones from below the jaw, so we don't know. A common indication of whether or not something is bipedal or quadrupedal has to do with how wide the jawbone is at the back. Because if it's real wide, then the larynx, the throat, the esophagus, all that stuff, the tongue, can go straight down. That's a biped. But if the jaw on the back is narrow, then all that apparatus has to go out backwards. That's probably a quadruped. That's kind of one rule of thumb that they use in anthropological analysis. Well, the problem is the big jaw is deformed. When I got the big jaw and I was using it to reconstruct the skull, to reconstruct the whole figure, the jaw is actually torqued. It's twisted. So if you lay it down so that the teeth are dead level, on the back of the jaw, one end is 3/4 of an inch higher than the other end. It's that twisted that way. It would be reasonable to say if in the fossilization it twisted that much, Maybe it twisted narrower or compressed narrower. Maybe it really was wider. I think that's what Grover was using as his assumption. I don't know how to answer that myself personally as far as bipedal or quadrupedal. If I were to venture a guess, I would probably say quadruped, only because we don't even understand our bipedalism. We don't understand how we got here. That's never been properly explained in anthropology, and if we can't even explain it once, it seems a stretch to explain it twice. And if Giganto is also a biped, then you have it occurring twice, and that's a stretch in terms of explaining evolutionary actions. So he's probably a quadruped. If he's a quadruped, then you do have to get him in order to be Bigfoot. He's got to go into a whole evolution of bipedalism. And like I say, I'm beginning to appreciate that that's probably less likely than I had thought before. Also, his head is nearly vertical, the way that the skull seems to be reconstructed. Very short-faced, very, very vertical in structure. And from what I can see on Patty, when I really started looking more and more and more at her, I don't see a real vertical head, and I don't even see a big one. So trying more recently to go back and say, okay, she's got to somehow stand up, and the skull's got to get smaller, and the top of the skull's got to go backwards instead of upward. And I was starting to look at all of these evolutionary things, and it seemed more and more and more complicated to me, which means less and less likely. And because I have reconstructed some of these other hominid ancestors, I just kind of reviewed them in my mind, and I suddenly realized there's two really nice potential candidates that have perhaps even more in common with Patty than Giganto does and could very, very reasonably be ancestors worthy of consideration. So the other two that are pictured there, one of them is Blackie. He's based on a fossil commonly called the Black Skull. And it's a species, I believe it's Paranthropus aethiopicus, a very, very tongue twister to try to pronounce, and I may not have even gotten it right. But he's about 2.5 million years old, found in Africa, and has a very robust skull with a high sagittal crest and everything. The reason I'm not really sold on Blackie as far as being an ancestor is because the face juts out so far forward. Now, if Patty is our type specimen for a real creature, I see a real short face, not a projected face. And that kind of seems to give me a little bit of doubt about Blackie, but you got the sagittal crest and you've already got the bipedalism, so you're kind of close there. You need a little bit more eyebrow, maybe. But the one that I like for it, you know, it sounds like a cop trying to arrest somebody, but the one that I actually like for it is Zingianthropus, or Zinge. Sometimes it's called Boise Eye. That classic skull, OH5, was one that Lewis Leakey, found back in 59, I believe, in Olduvai Gorge. And it's a very short-faced, robust Australopithecine. And the Australopithecines are just kind of a large group of ancestors from 1.5 to 3.5 million years ago. It encompasses a lot of different species, actually. But Zinge was a very short-faced, robust Australopithecine with a small sagittal crest. And the more I looked at Patty, the more I was starting to think, you know, this really does kind of look like OH5. And so I went back to my pictures of Zinge that I had done the reconstruction on and kind of compared it in a couple of different views of my reconstruction and a couple of different views of Patty in some of the film, and it started looking a lot more like her than the other possibilities. Now, the only things that Zinge would need to do in order to become Patty, one is to get much taller, because the males were about 5'6", or 4'6", and I think the females were about 3.5 feet tall, based on the fossils they found so far. So they weren't terribly large, but humans weren't terribly large either at the same time, and they've managed to grow quite a bit since then. So I don't think that the growth in height is anything terribly difficult. You have this wonderful short face. You need a little bit more brow. You've already got the sagittal crest. You've already got the bipedalism. So in the last couple of months, my thoughts have kind of evolved on this, that the Zinge or the OH5, the Boisei type ancestor, to me starts looking more and more like a really wonderful prospect if Patty turns out to be real, and we're trying to figure, okay, where did she come from? You know, what's her ancestry? It starts looking pretty good to me.
Okay, now when you compare, you know, the Giganto and the Blackie and the Zinge to the photo of Patty that's on the blog right now, you know, you can see from this profile of Patty, and I've heard this discussed, and I even, you know, felt the same way. Her jaw, in my opinion, looks massive. But do you think that's more of the film being old, or what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen some of the attempts at, you know, enhancing the images to try to pull more detail out of it. I know that Owen Caddy is doing some intriguing things, and I've had some opportunities to communicate directly with him and such. But I wonder if the apparent massiveness of the jaw might be somehow accentuated simply by the light-dark pattern, the way it falls on the face. I just don't know myself personally. So I can see where, you know, it could be argued, yeah, he's got a massive jaw, but without really, you know, seeing a detail of how any hair pattern might exist, because hair patterns on hominid, human, and primate faces are kind of funny, as far as some of them form like a beard goatee, like a chimpanzee often has and some orangs have, and then some of them are completely clean in the cheek area going down into the jaw. Some of them are kind of even across that area, like in a gorilla. Of course, they vary a lot within humans and such, and I kind of wonder, since we don't know exactly what's going on with the hair there, if maybe there might be some kind of a hair structure that's creating a light-dark artifact that's kind of throwing us off on our perception of the jaw. So I can see where you'd have the concern. I would be hesitant to make any judgment myself about the jaw being particularly massive. It's easier to see in the profile that it doesn't seem to project out terribly far. So that's a little bit more of a cut-and-dried thing.
What about the nose structure on Zinge? I noticed that Zinge has a more flattened nose.
Yeah.
Is that one of those things that's pretty much open to, you know, whatever you think it might be? Or?
Yes. The nose, more than probably anything about the face, is pure speculation. He could have a nose like a proboscis monkey, for all we know. The nose is cartilaginous tissue. Nothing about it fossilizes, and unlike muscle, which has indications on the skull of its insertion and origin, and the insertion where it hooks up to the skull and grabs on, has little suture marks on the end of the muscle, and those will tell you a lot about how big the muscle is and exactly where it is. So you can look at a skull, and you can know a lot about its musculature, but cartilaginous tissue, zip. We know nothing about it. So bottom line, pure and simple, the nose is 100% guesswork. You know, you look at nature, and you try to at least just do something plausible. And I was kind of looking in part at real gorillas and in part at a beautiful portrait in an old book called 50 Million Years to Man by an Italian guy. I think his name is Carlo Ranzi or something like that. But anyways, a book called 50 Million Years to Man, a wonderful thing about human evolution. And he had some beautiful portraits of what he thought these might look like. And so I kind of used that plus gorilla as my influence when I put the nose on Zinge, but pure guesswork.
Okay. Now, when we talk about about Bigfoot, you know, or Patty being here in North America, we have to get whatever it is from Asia, where the majority of these skeletons have been found, into North America.
Mm-hmm.
Now, out of the ones that you've put on, you know, you've highlighted here, Giganto, Blackie, and Zinge, which ones had the best chance of actually making it to this country, and how?
Well, okay, Giganto is known to be Asian, South China, Vietnam, et cetera, and I believe there's some some gigantofossils in East India or Bangladesh or somewhere around there of the three jaws, but mainly China for giganto. Everything known about Blackie and Zinge is Africa only. But we do know that from all of the African prototypes that started in Africa 1.5 to 2 million years ago, somebody managed to get all the way to Asia and become Peking Man and some of the others, so that we know that the human species had no difficulty radiating out over Europe, Asia, and we also know the human species had absolutely no problem going north, Bering Strait land bridge into North America. So it's been done. We know it's physically possible. To say another bipedal primate did it as well becomes plausible in that sense. So even if you say that, well, Zinge and Blackie are only in Africa, so was the human ancestor of everybody today at the same point in time. So humans made it, so another hominid in the group theoretically could as well. You could even argue, this is hypothetical, I'll tell you right up front, but you could even argue that there was kind of a dynamic relationship between two different species, a competitive relationship in some way where the human species and this other species that might derive into Patty and such, they might have had some kind of a dynamic where one might go somewhere, the other might follow. Like one might be the hunter that actually, you know, brings down big game, and the other one might be the ones that kind of scavenge after it and literally follow them around. We see a lot of symbiotic relationships like that in nature, where one species actually kind of couples up with another or is dependent upon the activities of another, and so they stay close together. There is, of course, the alternate thing. People always want to say, well, how do they manage to evade us as well as they have, that we can't seem to even get a body? Well, maybe within this dynamic between human species and the ancestral form, maybe there actually was something in the way of a hostility relationship where they simply learned to stay away from us.
Kind of like a falling out.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you look like at the Galapagos Island species, the tortoise, the iguanas, the boobies, the you know, a lot of the hawks and everything there, they have no concept of fear of humans. You can just literally walk right up to them. Instinctively, they have zero sense of, you know, I should stay away from this thing that's walking on two legs. You can look at other animals, and they're instinctively hiding from us all the time. Now, I, from time to time, have kept a lot of birds, and there's a really beautiful bird called a Palawan peacock pheasant. It's in the pheasant family. Here's another cute little thing called a ruru. It's a Himalayan crested wood partridge. And they're notoriously secretive birds. You can go near a cage where they're in, and if you're 50 feet away, they will hide. A lot of other birds, they don't care. Like a Chinese golden pheasant, it'll come right out, right up to the wire, look you eyeball to eyeball, strut and walk around. No fear of you, but the Palawan peacock pheasant will hide every single time. Certain animals can acquire a sense of instinctive hesitancy about any proximity to something else. So it certainly might be plausible within the whole dynamic of human ancestors and another hominid line that might lead to Patty, it's perfectly reasonable to think that somewhere along the line that instinctive, watch out for those, they're dangerous, they're going to hurt you, stay away from them, that kind of thing actually could have been built up. You know, there's
okay.
Actual, some of the giganto stuff with Homo erectus in China also suggests that they had an interaction between the two of them, and that it might have actually been that Homo erectus hunted them, and that they might have had an instinctive aversion to the ancestral humans in the region. You know, they were the enemy, quote unquote. You know, there's some interesting dynamics like that that have potential for explaining some of the things.
Okay, let me try to phrase this a little bit differently.
Okay.
Let's see, the photos that you've provided, which one of these do you think bears a stronger possibility of being what we're looking for.
Now, after, like I say, a couple of months of looking at the whole Patterson film over and over again, if I were putting money on it, and if, let's say, somebody actually captured a body and had it under wraps, but you knew there was one, and they were going to run a DNA thing and everything to try to trace it back to some other primate, that whole number, and it, you know, they started a betting line in Vegas, I'd bet on Zinge.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. Sean, my trusty host, tells me that we have a caller.
Okay.
We had a caller.
Oh, we had a caller.
This board has dropped them off the face of the earth, so I'll try to get them back.
Okay.
All right, and okay, then let me ask you this. With Zinge, how much of the skeletal remains do we have?
Be honest with you, I don't know the full inventory on it. I do know they've got more than just a skull. I do believe they have some bones of different parts of the body as well, but I'll be very candid with you. I sort of lost track of some of that, and so I don't want to go off on a limb and guess something that
right.
I don't know. I believe there is more than just skulls, like in Giganto. I believe there is
right.
some kind of, oh, possibly leg bones, arm bones, you know, something like that, but I don't know the specific inventory of it.
You know, I mean, it's always, right, and well, yeah, and I wouldn't want you to put yourself in a position where you
yeah.
could be told later that you were really wrong.
Yeah.
I don't
well,
do that
do
either.
Well, they do that anyways, but.
Sure.
Yeah, well, that's not new.
Okay, let me ask you this question, and
yeah.
I've always found this very fascinating. Like,
right.
take, for instance, with Giganto.
Mm-hmm.
We have teeth and we have a mandible.
Yes.
And for those of you listening, a mandible is the jaw, the lower jaw.
Yes. Right.
Now, from those things, they've been able to recreate or reconstruct what they think is the entire skull.
Yeah.
Usually when things like this are done, what's the degree of accuracy? And, you know, a lot of people out there don't know that, you know, these reconstructed skulls of Giganto that they're seeing for sale
mm-hmm.
are a good guess.
Yeah.
What's the usually the degree of accuracy?
Oh, boy, I don't know how to put a number on it. It's kind of a continuum of less and less and less and less and less accurate the further you radiate out from the actual fossil. Okay. Now, the reconstruction that I used, and I think it's pictured in one of those diagrams, that was done actually by Russell Shahan at University of Iowa and a scientific illustrator named Stephen Nash. And they did that front side view, and then I built a three-dimensional version of it. The one that is sold, as far as I know, is based on one that Grover Krantz did. And so those are two distinctly different interpretations. The one that Russell Shahan and Stephen Nash did that I worked from is more vertical and is a narrower jaw at the base and presumes by or quadrupedal. And Grover chose something that was more kind of a backward skull, wider jaw, and leading to bipedal. You try to take what you know and try to connect it to something which would seem to fit it. Think of it like a jigsaw puzzle. You have a piece. You know something about the piece that will fit it based upon just simply reversing the outline. But you don't know the other side of that piece. And you don't know what the next one is. So you know a little bit about the missing piece, but not everything. As soon as you go to the next piece, you know less. That's the kind of thing it is with the whole fossil. So we have the jaw. We can reasonably construct an upper jaw. We have the end of the jawbone where at least it's starting to rise upward, so we kind of get a sense of how long it is front to back compared to how tall it is, up top to bottom. So that gives us a sense of how high it might rise up and how far back it might go. That sort of gets us going on that, but then you start interpolating, you know, the cheekbone and the brow ridge and everything else, and then it starts getting fuzzier and fuzzier and fuzzier. And so there isn't any line of demarcation where you can say, this part's fact, this part's fiction. You've got kind of, like I say, as you radiate out from the actual fossil, every feature out further, if it doesn't directly connect to it, starts to get a little speculative. Go a little further, gets a little more. Go a little further, gets a little more. The skull reconstructions, both of them, are probably pretty close. I think if somebody finally finds one, I suspect it'll be pretty close to one of the two, but I won't venture a guess of which one. But now go on to the body. Now, I did the body from after Russ and Stephen did the skull. And for the body, I knew going in, it's pure guesswork. I mean, there's nothing to go by. All I could do was take a skeleton of a real gorilla, a diagram of one, and a diagram of the largest fossil primate next to the size of a gorilla, which is a big baboon called Therapithecus oswaldi. And I took those two skeletons and I basically just sort of hybridized the two of them. I mixed half and half. That's about as big a quadrupedal primate as we're going to find, and then scaled it up to the skull. But that basically is pure speculation. You know, I mean, we could find when, you know, we finally do discover a complete skeleton of Giganto, he could be 4 foot six, you know, with a real big head, and surprise, surprise. Wow. We just don't know. It really is guesswork.
Right.
You know.
Well, were there full skull or full skeletons found of either a black ear's inch?
I don't know the extent of the inventory.
Well, when you worked on the reconstructions for the museum,
I just worked from skull. The only one I did full body was Lucy, because they really did have like 40% of her full skeleton. So I was able Lucy that way.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, I mean, the question becomes, you know, I mean, for me in my mind, I don't know if you can answer this or not, but, you know, I mean, the skull makes it over millions of years to be found and, you know, cataloged.
Right.
So what happens, why the rest of the body, the skeletal structure breaks down so much easier? I mean, is it just the
skull is
tougher?
I don't know that it breaks down. I think it has something to do with how the specimen dies. See, if it's attacked by carnivores and killed by hyenas or lions at the time or something like that, it's entirely possible. If you've ever watched a couple of lions, you know, tearing apart some kind of a body, they just rip it to pieces and they carry off a big chunk of it. And so it's entirely possible that the head got disconnected from the body and just didn't show up. Those kinds of things can happen depending on the cause of death. Then you have the question that when things do tend to fossilize, if the skeleton breaks up and there's no more connective tissue, then the bones are not connected to each other. You know, they really are loose bones. You just have some kind of a flash flood go washing through there and a bunch of mud coming down, and that can scatter the bones completely. And then you got a skull over here and you got a thigh down the street and, you know, all of that. And where you finally find the particular fossil, there's no guarantee any of the other bones are in the immediate area. Might be if you're lucky, but no guarantee. So with the whole fossilization process, about the only time you actually find anything close to a full skeleton is if the animal or hominid or whatever died suddenly and is buried rather quickly before the body is dismembered, either by carnivores, scavengers, or forces of nature and earth. So it's actually an unusual occurrence for a body to be intact enough that you actually find a lot of the stuff in one spot. That's actually a rare find. So, you know, they might find a skull of Zinj here and digging somewhere else. They find a bone and they think it's the same thing. And they find, you know, a collarbone here and part of a pelvis here and some foot bones here. And then they have to kind of sort out and even figure, okay, which specimen is it? Well, if there's only one in the area, they usually tend to assume, okay, that's more of that same species. If they got a couple of species in the same area, then it gets really confusing, and they'll fight for years over, you know, oh, okay, the femur belongs to this one, not that one, kind of a thing, and they can fight for the, some of the wars that the anthropologists have is just astonishing over issues like that. So it's clouded. Let's put it that way.
All right, folks, we got a caller from the 662 area code. 662, you're on the air, Sasquatch Experience. Sean Forker, Melissa Hovey, James Baker, and Bill Munns.
It's Henry, of course, and I should have Bill Green with me. Bill, you there?
Yes, how y'all doing?
fine, Bill. How are you?
Good. Bill, I'd like to ask you a question. Have you ever worked with the actors Roy Scheider, Donald Pleasence, or Ben Chapman?
No, I don't believe I have worked with any of those three.
Oh, okay. Are you currently researching or investigating any Sasquatch sightings in your state or in other states with other researchers?
No, I'm not actually out in the field doing any kind of research. Part of it's employment, part of it's location. There just aren't a lot of them in Los Angeles. You know, I mean, a few at Sunset and Vine maybe, but, you know, just generally speaking, you know, there's not a lot of them here, and I'm sort of, you know, stuck in suburbia here. So I don't get out much to do any of that. My research, what I'm really trying to do, is really focus on applying my knowledge of the whole suit thing to really try and study more about the prospect of if it's a suit and see if I can. What I'm hoping to do is actually bring some hard data to the table about materials and processes and the physical dynamics of what they can do and not do. So we really can't take it out of the realm of, in my professional opinion, another creature guy says, in my professional opinion. I'd love to see it get beyond that to hard data. So in a way, my hopes of doing research initially is along that line. If I had the time, the money, and a whole lot of forest anywhere nearby, I have enough confidence that the phenomenon is worthy of research that I'd probably be out there looking with a bag of plaster in my knapsack. But not at the moment.
Bill, what do you think about the new X-Files sequel that's coming out July 28th, I believe?
I wasn't even aware of it, actually. Is it TV or movie?
Oh, it's a movie. It's a new movie.
I hadn't heard anything about it, actually.
I didn't think the first one was that great.
Yeah.
Okay, well, Henry, do you have a question for Mr. Munns? Because we have another caller waiting on the line.
Mine was already answered earlier, so I'm going to let y'all go. And thanks for answering Bill's question.
You're welcome. Sure.
Yeah, thank you, Bill.
Thanks for calling in, guys.
Bye.
Thank you, Henry May and Bill Green, for your calls. We appreciate them each and every week, as always. We have another caller from the 310 area code. 310, you're on the air. Sean Forker, Melissa Hovey, James Baker, Bill Munns, the Sasquatch Experience. 310?
I'm here.
Hello, what's your question for the guest?
My question is, I know Bill Munns has mentioned before on the Bigfoot Forum that he doesn't see anything peculiar with the gait on the Patterson film, and I'm wondering if he's seen anything recently to make him basically speculate, is this an abnormal gait? Is this a gait that a human would not be able to accomplish?
Okay, interesting question. Having seen a lot of what humans can do, stunt people, dancers, etc., like that, I suppose I tend to be rather optimistic in thinking that humans can actually do some rather remarkable things. But that's not a scientific observation. That's just kind of an intuitive cultural one. My expertise isn't in bipedal locomotion. I'll tell you that right up front. So there may be things about that movement and the way that the knees bend, and I know it's called the compliant gait and all of that. There may be things about that from a locomotion standpoint that really do cause into question the credibility of a human doing it, but I wouldn't be the one to actually know what those are. And what I'm trying to do very candidly is I'm trying not to sort of suggest expertise that I don't have. And in terms of locomotion, I'll readily concede I don't really have any scientific basis where I could make a judgment myself. So I haven't looked at it in a great amount of detail, and I would be hesitant to make any decision on that precisely because I haven't looked into it. about the only thing I'll say, I finally did see that Legend Meets Science DVD. There's something in there about the knees wobbling side to side. I'll tell you right up front, I found that sort of unbelievable. I don't know how they interpolated that from the video. That seemed to me rather incredible in terms of that determination. But in terms of the knees being bent and everything else like that, clearly other people with more expertise in locomotion, more expertise than I, they've looked at it and they've certainly published a lot about it and discussed it. So I would end up probably deferring to one of those other experts on that subject rather than venture an opinion myself.
Right. Well, I'm glad you finally got to watch the DVD that you were sent. And
yeah.
Is there any way a suit would inhibit someone's walk? Would a suit weigh them down or cause the mime to walk with a gait like that?
In theory, a suit can, depending on how it's structured, but it's usually when you're doing a real bizarre kind of an alien thing where you're actually trying to change the whole look of the body. Given that all of the joints, the foot, the ankle, the knee, the pelvis, the shoulder, they're all sort of in the right spot, and presumably there isn't any rigid structure inside it if it's a suit that's needed to support some other, you know, mechanical thing in there. If it's just costume and padding, there isn't anything I can think of that would either restrict a person's walking or maybe prevent them from walking like that. So I wouldn't see the suit either causing the walk or inhibiting the walk either way. I would say, you know, a person could, any capability of doing that would lie with the capability of the person, whether they're in the suit or out of the suit. If they could do it out of the suit, I would assume they could do it in the suit. But it would come down to the capability of the person. I wouldn't expect the suit to really play a factor.
Caller, we'd like to thank you for calling in and asking your questions. We appreciate it. Bill, I have a question for you, and maybe you touched on this earlier. I don't remember offhand. It's a question about materials that were available in 1967 to make the Patterson film.
Right.
To make a suit that seems so elaborate, were the materials available to make a suit of that caliber at that time?
Well, the big question, the single most critical thing, is the question of whether there was a fur material that had a certain amount of stretch to it. The stretch materials that are used now were not introduced to the industry until 1985, or early 80s, by National Fiber Technology. The suit materials, or the fur materials that existed before that, basically, they were ones that did not stretch. And so any motion of that fur material causes it to tend to fold more like cloth. Okay, that's the problem with it. That is the single most important material issue about what was there then as compared to what is there now. And the question is whether or not this standard fur cloth would bend, fold, stretch, or otherwise move in a manner consistent with what you see in the film. So whenever people say, oh, the materials weren't available at the time, the one material that they're really talking about is the fur cloth. You know, the existent fur cloths of the time didn't stretch, didn't move very well, didn't allow any sense of musculature showing through it and such like that. If you could see them moving, they'd bend like cloth. So that would be the single prominent issue about stuff then, stuff now.
All right, thank you. That answered my question on that.
Mm-hmm.
We do have one question from the chat room, and I don't know if you're going to be able to answer it or not because I don't know that you had that type of information when you did the reconstructions of Australopithecus.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was Zinge.
Yeah.
Somebody was asking if the larynx of
yeah.
Australopithecus would have allowed for speech.
Okay. First, the analysis of the larynx, you need the skull, you need the jaw, you need some
right.
of the neck vertebrae
right.
and such like that to try and reconstruct the tissue of the jaw. Now, I know that a lot of people, a lot of anthropologists get into some fierce arguments about whether or not we could speak or whatever like that. And I'll be very honest with you, I think a lot of them are appallingly silly. They subscribe to what I like to call the Henry Higgins School of Anthropology. They seem obsessed with the idea of whether or not you can make a vowel sound, and if you can't make a vowel sound, you can't have articulate speech, as Henry Higgins told Eliza Doolittle. I think that's utterly ridiculous. Communication doesn't depend on vowel sounds. Communication simply requires two individuals, one who does something with meaning attached, and the other one who observes what was done and has the same meaning. Now, whether you're making sounds with your mouth or you're making hand signals or whether you're beating on a log or a drum or anything like that, they're all forms of intelligent communication. Morse code is an exquisite example of intelligent communication. The whole idea that you couldn't have intelligent communication or speech, so to speak, until you had a larynx of a certain structure, personally, I don't buy that for a second. If the larynx can make noise, all you need is two species, or two of the same species, to agree on what the specific noise means. So a certain yell, a certain hoot, a certain snarl, a certain whistle, if that means trouble, that's communication. If that means we're cool, we're friends, fine. If it means you want a date tonight, you know, fine. But it doesn't matter about vowels, and it really, in my opinion, doesn't matter about the shape of the larynx. If the larynx can make sounds, then the individuals can assign meaning to those sounds. And once they do, they can communicate.
The person that was asking the question said that there was an indention in the back of the skull.
Okay.
As far as the placement for the larynx.
Yeah.
Does that have anything to do with speech?
Well, some people do. This is the theory that a lot of anthropologists and such say that they think that a certain structure of the larynx is important to make sounds, particularly vowel sounds. They look at the larynx of a chimpanzee and say they can't make those sounds, so they can't speak articulately. So you can determine some things like that from the fossil to get a suggestion of where the larynx might have been and whether it tends to more resemble a chimpanzee's larynx or human larynx. Okay, you can determine that from the fossil. Where I disagree with them is that I don't see that where the larynx is, because there is one, no matter where it is in the throat, there is one. I disagree with whether or not that has any connection to the capacity of intelligent communication, because intelligent communication is not about what kind of sound you can make. It's just about assigning a meaning to the sound you are capable of making. I divorce those as two separate things. A lot of anthropologists, I mean, they write whole books about this, when they could speak and this and that, and they seem to think if you can only have intelligent communication if you can make vowel sounds, that a hoot, a growl, isn't an intelligent communication. But if you look at the Bushman language, for example, the African Bushman, it's a lot of clicks and whistles, but it's an intelligent form of communication. Then there's also a lot of people who can make great vowel sounds who don't have an ounce of intelligence, you know. World is full of us. I separate those two. The mechanics of the larynx, in my opinion, has absolutely no relevance at all as to when intelligent communication may have occurred in our ancestry. As far as I'm concerned, it has to do with the brain, the capacity to think about communicating, and then the two of the species just have to agree on what the sounds, symbols, actions, gestures mean. I mean, if you look at baseball, you know, where the coach is communicating with the players out on the field, rubbing their nose, pulling their ear, you know, tipping their hat and all of that, it's communication because they agreed on what it means. If I scratch my nose, it means bunt. If I pull my ear, it means, you know, swing away. they have agreed on what it means, even though it's a hand gesture. Now, all that takes is the intelligence of the mind, not the mechanics of larynx or not, hand or not. You know, that just doesn't matter to me. That's kind of the way I look at it. So fossils, yes, can probably tell you whether the larynx was high up or low or front or back or big or small or something like that. Certain aspects of it probably can. But I don't connect that to intelligent communication. I see those as two completely separate issues. So
okay.
Where the larynx was on our ancestor, I don't correlate that to when did we start
speaking radio.
Oops, we're done.
It'll be archived. I had a question on your, as far as intelligent communication goes, and
yeah.
I'm going to use my dog as a reference, so... My dog isn't intelligent. I mean, she's semi-intelligent, but the fact is that she knows if she makes a certain noise, I will send her out.
Yeah.
So I am smarter than her, but she has learned by training to make that noise.
Right.
So could it be at one point that something smarter explained to him, hey, if you make this noise, this other one won't get near you?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Maybe, like you had said earlier, maybe we at one point, the humans... and the Bigfoot were a closer unit, you know, and maybe having a larger brain or even maybe something with a larger brain said, hey, you know, if you make this noise, everybody within a 20-foot range or if you do this certain signal, every Bigfoot within a so many feet range knows that you're not going to be messed with today and to go somewhere else.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
That communication exists all through nature. And species learn from other species what those signals mean. You look at antelopes out in the African plain, they can look at lions that are sitting around doing nothing, and they know that's a nonviolent posture if they're just all laying in the sun. And they know what an attack posture looks like. They know the difference between the two. Species definitely study each other and learn from each other, yeah. Definitely does.
Okay. Well, is my co-host there?
Sean is here trying to get the board to unmute me. Sorry. This board is, I'm having just a horrible time with the board tonight, folks.
Yeah.
I apologize.
It's okay.
This is going to be one heck of a show, though, for the archives. The folks in the chat room seem to like it.
Do we want to do the which animal's the killer before we sign off?
Yes, please.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
Sean,
Sean,
take a guess. Yes.
Which animal is the killer?
Yes.
Ooh.
Lion, elephant, orangutan.
Orangutan.
Nope. The elephant.
The elephant.
I wanted to say elephant because I've seen a lot of movies on elephants, and they say once those things get mad, get it.
Her name was Misty. She worked for years as the disappearing elephant in the Blackstone Magic Show. She worked fine with a trainer that disciplined her, but she had a mean streak. And a zookeeper at Lion Country Safari found her one day out of her pen. He went up to her, as much as we know, tried to tell her to go back to her barn. She disobeyed. He didn't know what was going on. She figured, aha, sucker. And she crushed his head and killed him. And so she was taken out of circulation as a moving animal and just put away in a sanctuary somewhere. But,
well, at least she was sanctuaried. Usually that kind of thing, they kind of
put them down.
Well, no, actually, I was explaining this to Melissa earlier. The rule with trained animals is they get one kill, and they get to stay alive. If they kill a second person, they're put down.
Ah.
One time, they always say, hey, the animal's just doing the animal's thing. But if they kill a second time, they put them down routinely. It's a weird rule.
I wonder if we could get that one rule.
James, if that's the case, you would have been done many times ago.
Exactly, yeah.
He works retail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It'd be a great job if it wouldn't be for the customers, you know, and, well, associates. I watched Clerks last week, and I'll tell you what, I appreciate my job a lot more.
Well, folks, I'd just like to take a moment and thank Bill Munns for joining us tonight. Bill, thank
pleasure.
You very much.
You're welcome.
Melissa, great interview as always. James, love the bake shop. And folks, we will see you next week. Melissa, who's our guest for next week?
I believe that we're still waiting for a confirmation on.
All right. So when we get that confirmation, we'll post it.
Yep.
We'll post it, folks.
Before we sign off, sorry.
Oh, go ahead, James. Go ahead.
Before we sign off, I'd like people to remember my MySpace account, because the fact is I'm my next week's show, or my next week, I'd like to set up making a lore for possibly Bigfoot, and I'd like to get some people's opinions. I had this question asked to me, you know, what kind of thing would you put together for lore, and I answered in my blog, and a lot of the things that I put on the Bay Shop are from my blog. So if you want to see it a couple days earlier, a lot of times it shows up on my blog, and then we talk about it on the show. So that was it. Sorry.
All right, folks, there you have it. I'm Sean Forder for Melissa Hovey and James Baker and our good guest tonight, Bill Munns. We'll see you next week, folks, and until then, keep on scratching. Good night, everybody.